Okay, we can start our practice. Please get comfortable with your posture. And try to keep your back straight as much as possible. And take a few deep, long breaths. Breathe in through your nose and breathe out through your mouth. To relax your body and relax your mind, and gently close your eyes. And observe your body from top of your head to the tips of your toes. And to make sure your whole body is relaxed, free of tension. You all are here in this beautiful morning, in this sanctuary. And go deep within yourself and asking the questions of why am I here? Having a right intention towards our practice. It's important. You may be here to investigate yourself, your mind, find peace of mind, balance in life. Use this opportunity and time to investigate within yourself because most of the things you are finding and try to find the answers lays within ourselves. All we need to be patient and to investigate within ourselves in order to find those answers. Having a right foundation, a strong foundation, is essential for our practice. Our foundation is cultivating love and compassion within ourselves and towards others, loving kindness meditation. Think to yourself, may I be well? May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be well. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. May I be well. May I be happy. May I be peaceful. Now send your loving and kind thoughts towards your family members. Think about them individually if you wish. Your parents, your grandparents, your husband, your wife, your children, your grandchildren, your partners, sometimes you may have a difficult family members in your families, hard to get along with. Because you may have had negative interactions in the past, or you may not like the way they talk to you, the way they treat you. Sometimes we have a difficulty of dealing with people who are very close to us. If you think deeply, because of the expectations that we have sometimes, it has nothing to do with them at times. Or it could be something that happened in the past that you won't be able to forget, forgive. Please understand, we all are human beings. We all make mistakes. Forgiveness is a strong, powerful practice. Forgiving does not mean forgetting. When you forgive somebody, they don't gain anything, but you will gain a peace of mind by letting go of those negative feelings and emotions towards them. By forgiving and letting go of the past will help you to move forward without so much of burdens. And send your loving and kind thoughts towards all of your family members, including the difficult ones, thinking thus, may all my family members be well, be happy, be peaceful. May all my family members be well, be happy, be peaceful. May all my family members be well, be happy, be peaceful. Finally, send your loving and kind thoughts towards all living beings, human beings, non-human beings, people who are struggling without food, without shelters, people who are suffering because of the wars around the world, also from natural disasters. We all are one big family of brothers and sisters in this whole world. And send your loving and kind thoughts towards all living beings, thinking thus, may all living beings be well, be happy, be peaceful. May all living beings be well, be happy, be peaceful. May all living beings be well, be happy, be peaceful. Now all of you are the hearts and minds are full of love and compassion within yourself and towards others. Now please bring your attention to focus on your breathing. Don't force your breath. Just gently bring your attention to focus on your ordinary breath. And start paying attention to your in-breath and out-breath as it naturally happens. When you pay attention to your in-breath and out-breath, you may start to feel a subtle sensation of your breathing. Maybe on your upper lips or inside your nostril, perhaps back of your throat. Or sometimes you may feel in your belly as it arises with in-breath and falls away with out-breath. Wherever you feel that subtle sensation of your breathing, and start to pay attention to that part of your body and try to keep your attention there. When you try to do this, you may find yourself get distracted with your thoughts. And don't try to stop your thoughts. Whenever you realize that you get distracted with your thoughts, accept and acknowledge that you got distracted and gently bring your attention back to focus on your breathing. This may happen many times. As many times as it happens, each time bring your attention back to focus on your breathing. Now please bring your palms together in front of your heart and observe your mind and feel the calmness and relaxation that you have within yourself. Make a strong determination to practice meditation every day, even for a short time. May no harm come to you. May no difficulties come to you. May you be well. May you be happy. May you be peaceful. Thank you very much. You can open your eyes. Let's do the chanting. Start with page 4. Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse. Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse. Namo tasse bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhasse. Buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Dutiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi buddhaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi dhammaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Tatiyampi sanghaṃ saraṇaṃ gacchāmi. Anicca vata saṅkhārā upāda vaya dhammino. Upajjitvā niruñjanti te saṁ upa samo sukho sabbe sattā avērā hontu. Sabbe sattā abhyāpajjā hontu. Sabbe sattā anīgā hontu. Sabbe sattā sukhī attānaṃ pariharantu. Mano pubbhaṅgamā dhammā. Mano settā manomayā. Manasā ce paduṭṭhena bhāsati vā karoti vā. Tato naṁ dukkha manveti cakkhaṃ va vahato padaṃ. Mano pubbhaṅgamā dhammā. Mano settā manomayā. Manasā ce pasannena bhāsati vā karoti vā. Tato naṁ sukha manveti chāyāva anapāyini. Mind is the foreign of all states. We believe in generosity towards others. We believe the skillful, noble path is marked by generosity. We believe generosity has many levels. Think generously, speak generously, act generously. May I become at all times, both now and forever, a protector for those without protection, a guide for those who have lost their way, a ship for those with ocean to cross, a sanctuary for those in danger, a lamp for those without light, a place of refuge for those who lack shelter, and a servant to all in need. By means of this meritorious deed, may I never join with unwise, only the wise, until the time I attain Nirvana. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Good to see you all, and thank you for coming. Hope you had a good practice. Is anybody new today? Yeah, please say your name. Renata, thank you for coming. Nelly? Lily, thank you for coming, Lily. Welcome to the temple. Mary, thank you for coming and welcome to the temple. Yeah. Jill? Yeah, thank you for coming. Welcome to the temple. Yeah. Edna, thank you for coming and welcome to the temple. Okay. Oh, yes. Thank you. Thank you. today... I have been talking for last month, so I'm tired of talking. I'm going to take a little break. Our dear friend and president of Blue Lotus, the Tyler, is going to give the today's talk. Tyler, it's all yours.
This one's dead. Good morning, everybody. Lynn, we're so happy to welcome you here as our special guest. We're really grateful to see you. I so blew this, you guys. This is hilarious. So he asked me last night if I would give the talk, and I said, sure, what would you like to make the talk about? And he said, how to love difficult people. And so I thought about two things. I thought he must be watching too much news. But then I realized, oh, he must be wanting to learn how to deal with me. But then this morning, I prepared the talk, and this is a subject that we all agree we probably could talk about for 8 hours or 8 days, and so to do it in less than 30 minutes is a little bit of a challenge. But what I realized is I completely bombed already, because I actually thought it was how to deal with difficult people, not how to love difficult people. So we'll see if I can translate this in real time, the difference between dealing with difficult people and loving them. But maybe we'll discover they're the same thing. Is there anybody here that would be brave enough to acknowledge that they're not dealing with difficult people right now? Do we have anybody that's not? You're not dealing with a single difficult person? I'd love to give you the microphone. Now sit down. Yeah, it is hilarious, actually. And then I was going to ask the second question, is there anybody here who's not ever been someone else's difficult problem? And if we actually just think about that, those two positions, maybe there's not much else to consider, is there? Like, it immediately... could allow you to evoke some compassion and empathy towards difficult folks if you recognize that likely you have been one as well, right? So I've been in a couple of businesses for a really long time that I think by their very nature seem to attract people. I don't want to say it attracts difficult people, but I want to say that it invokes the difficulty a more difficult season of people's lives and the businesses that I'm in. And so I've had a lot of practice on navigating lots of personalities and lots of difficult people. And I sat down this morning thinking about what I wanted to talk about, and I ended up really sort of doing a personal inventory of what are some of the techniques and mindsets and skills I've used in dealing with so many people during their difficult seasons. And I just want to acknowledge I'm so proud of myself for calling them a difficult season rather than difficult people. Like, it's so non-condemning, but it isn't how my mind first thinks of it. So the first thing that I was thinking about is I am these days obsessed with words. I think that words are so powerful and so, so critical and so important. And I believe that we have entered an era where it seems as though many of us are carrying around different definitions to the same word. And a lot of times the discord that we feel and the unharmony between each other is often more associated with the fact that we have sort of written our own definitions, but we haven't told others, or we don't seek to understand what's your definition of this word or your definition of this word. And so step one for me around difficult people is beginning to rephrase it. A difficult person, instead of calling them a difficult person, rephrasing it to someone or someone or some being that I'm having difficulty with. Instead of them being a difficult person, like as it's in an entirety, I like to rephrase it and say, I am having a difficulty with this part of them, not this whole of them. And it's been really important and fundamental for me to make a distinction between difficult people and their difficult behaviors or actions. You know, where I grew up, my grandma would say, love the sin, hate, you know, love the sinner, hate the sin kind of a thing. I think this is a similar concept to that. So the first step for me in difficult people is this, rephrasing it and to say that I'm the one actually with the struggle because it's my responsibility to have the exchange with them, and to really reframe it and say I'm having a struggle with a part of someone, not the whole of someone. The second one is I had a really weird childhood, and I had periods of my childhood where I was raised in a commune. And that teacher was very wonderful and very controversial. And one of the cores of his teaching was everything is a device for our spiritual growth. So he really instructed us to refrain from the common judgments of right and wrong, good and bad, and to look at everything as an opportunity for our spiritual growth. And so I was thinking about that when it comes to difficult people, or the parts of them that are difficult, it has been such a gift to me to remember that other teaching and to say, what is this here for me to learn? What is there here for me to increase my practice, up my empathy, up my compassion, up my kind of commitment to loving exchanges? And I don't love the word enemy, but I also don't want to rephrase this because it is directly from the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama calls this sort of relationship between ourselves and the difficult parts of people, he calls it the enemy's gift. And here's a direct quote from that. As a genuine practitioner of compassion, you must develop tolerance. And in order to practice sincerely and to develop patience, you need someone who will willfully hurt you. Thus, these people give us real opportunities to practice these things. They are testing our inner strength in a way that even your guru cannot. Even the Buddha possesses no such potential. Therefore, the enemy is the only one who gives us this golden opportunity. This is a remarkable conclusion, isn't it? By thinking along these lines and using these reasons, you will eventually develop a kind of extraordinary respect towards your enemies. Number three in the things I've been thinking about on how to deal with the difficult parts of people. I really love the sort of the phrase, each of us is more than the worst things we've ever done. Each of us is more than the worst things we've ever done. I have a very, 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 very dear friend who was in prison for 27 years. I really love him. He's been an incredible asset to me, and he caused tremendous suffering. All of those things are true in the same human and in the same relationship. Each of us is more than the worst thing we've ever done. It's so beneficial for me to remember that and to not condemn the entirety of someone for a part of themselves. The fourth one, I guess I really like mantras. I've never really admitted that before, but I do kind of live my life sort of like sometimes in a death grip, holding onto a phrase I repeat over and over again in order to get through something. And one of those that I use a lot in work is be curious, not furious. Be curious, not furious. And I think that is actually a pretty direct Buddhist teaching in my point of view, because a more proper Buddhist teaching would be to use a three-step recipe for getting out of delusion with anger, which is to recognize, reduce, and abandon. Like, first you recognize the anger, then you reduce it, and then you abandon it. And I'll tell you, I really love this one a lot, because I did it in reverse. In my family, to be in a bad mood or to have a feeling that is less than noble was really a condemnable act. We were told to be very positive no matter how we felt. And I now like to say that I really hate positive thinking. I much prefer positive doing. But I would abandon my anger before I recognized it, which of course means I didn't abandon it. What I did was I gutted it, and then it would come out like a nuclear explosion at the worst possible time and create a far bigger mess than if I had just recognized it, which by the power of awareness already begins to reduce it, which by power of that begins to abandon it, right? So I've had to learn to flip the script and to not abandon it first just because I was taught that anger was such a bad thing, and said first recognize it, first then reduce it, and then abandon it. If I don't let that emotion take over, right, if I just acknowledge it first, my mind becomes much more settled and less reactionary. And are any of you familiar with Pema Chodron's latest book? It's called How You Live Is How You Die. I think you guys have all heard me say this before. I mostly believe that a title might sometimes be all you need to read of most books. So How You Live Is How You Die is the name of her newest book. And she did write it post-pandemic, which I really appreciate, reading things right now that are post one of the biggest experiences many of us have experienced in our adult lives. So it's very enlightening to me to read those. I think we have some copies of it in there. But I'm only halfway through, so don't hear me endorsing it. But I'm really interested in a particular chapter. And I think I'm interested in it because it's a journey I'm currently on, where I have a pretty powerful intellect. I'm a very curious person, and I am plagued with extreme ambition. And I'm in the process of trying to let go of some of that and re-understand, like, what is the root of that, those behaviors, and what can I lay down that's no longer serving me. And one of the things I'm really trying to do is move into more body awareness than head awareness. In the book Bhante and I wrote, you guys might remember, we talk a lot about going from what he calls head dharma to heart dharma. Like, a lot of us have intellectual understanding, but we're still pretty gross out in the world because we haven't like taken what we know and turned it into our behavior and our actions. So in Pima's new book, she talks about a Vipassana scan, but she talks about cutting off your head. And metaphorically, she's referring to your intellect. When you have something going on, like dealing with a difficult part of a person, and you have a reaction to it, my intellect wants to solve it. And what that does is it sort of gaslights my body. It's like a spiritual bypass. I'm not actually like feeling it and figuring out what's going on. And so what she asks you to do is, I think, probably one of the most important spiritual principles, which is to pause. And then to do a body scan, but only from your neck down. and acknowledge where is that feeling state in your body below your neck when you're in a difficult exchange, and notice where it is. For me, when I do that, it's almost always a tingling sensation on my chest and on the front of my arms. And the reference she uses is, if you sit in a Vipassana or in a body scan from the neck down and you don't allow it to go to your head, do not do a scan on your head, because now you're accessing intellect, or where she says intellect lives. What she believes that it's the equivalent of unplugging your vacuum cleaner in mid-vacuum. It literally takes out the power source of the charged feeling. And that essentially that's actually all there is to do. That's her argument, that that's all there is to do, is to pause, pay attention below the level of your neck, notice where the frustration or the feeling sensation is in your body, and that that is the equivalent of defueling it, you know, unplugging it. And so I thought that was a little hokey, you know, to be honest, but I kept trying it. And a remarkable experience happened almost at the very first time. I was unable to escalate myself back to that charged feeling prior to the pause in the scan. I'm not saying it went away. That would be idealistic, and I'm not that person. But it was a significant turning down of the volume. And I suspect most of us would agree, we don't need the feeling to go away. We just need it to become slightly less boiling so that we can manage it in a better way, in a more healthy way, right? The next one is, there is a very sound Buddhist teaching that I really love. In fact, I have a note on my desk that says this. It says, who can see suffering is not themselves suffering. Who can see suffering is not themselves suffering. And so my grandma was the head of the art department at U of I for 40 years. She was an extraordinary artist. And she would do this activity with me. We'd spend summers together a lot. And we would drive down a city block in Champaign-Urbana. And she would ask me from one stop sign to the next, which she would drive like 3 miles an hour to the point where you just wanted to die, and or at least the 12-year-old version of me did. And she would say, tell me what you saw. And then she would drive around the block and start again. And then she would say, now I want you to see a little more. Tell me what you saw. And she would sometimes do this 40 and 50 times. My more intellectual family thought it was a form of abuse, I think. But the gift she gave me has been like one of the greatest treasures of my adult life, the ability to see so much more than others often see, to have this really broad, deep awareness of my surroundings and the implication of things and how things all work together. And so this concept of asking yourself, who can see suffering is not themselves suffering. This looking for suffering in others, or acknowledging that everyone has a story we don't know, everyone is dealing with stuff we don't know, by really practicing keeping that front of mind, it makes difficult interactions so much more manageable, because I cannot help but evoke empathy and compassion towards them and wonder what might also be going on. The next one is, I've often thought about my life and the times where I'm in relationship versus single, right? Just using that lens. And what I remember many times is like the single times just felt so relieving, but then they quickly moved towards wanting a relationship again, and I wonder why that is. But as my journey has deepened, I've understand that it's really in relationship that our stuff comes up. It's in relationship that we get triggered. It's in relationship that we have the opportunity to rupture and repair. And when you're out of relationship, you actually aren't benefiting from all of those riches. And so to consider conflict or difficult parts of people as a benefit has been a real blessing to me. I found this phrase I just wanted to read that is from the Dhammapada that I think maybe you will all relate with. Being in a relationship is just like being in a rock tumbler. In a rock tumbler, you get these jagged, rough stones, and you stick them in the tumbler, turn the wheel, and they bang around for a while. Then eventually, they come out polished and very beautiful. Ideally, this is how it goes in Sangha. And for those of you new people, we call this community a Sangha. This is how it goes in Sangha. All these people come in, they're a bit rough, and then they bang off each other. But they bang off each other in such a way that that's awake and present, and they're really dealing with stuff. And then hopefully you end up coming up as a polished jewel. There's people in here I've banged with, and we've made each other more polished as a result, for sure. I can't think of anywhere I go where I don't bang into people and we make each other better, or sometimes worse, depending on what's happening. The next one is this concept that I started out asking you about, which is, have you ever been one of the difficult people? I'm a huge believer in doing my own inventory. I've been sober 31 years, and it's a very common practice to like turn the mirror and say, what was my role in this? What did I do? How am I participating? My therapist would like to say, you know, the phrase, sweep your own side of the street. He has assured me that there's no asphalt left on my side of the street. I need to knock it off and let other people be held accountable for their own actions. But mostly still, I believe, I am responsible for my own growth and my own behavior, and I need to keep sweeping my own side of the street. One of the things I really do like asking myself when I'm dealing with the difficult parts of people is, how am I at times one of those difficult people? Really taking a fierce and moral inventory and saying, how am I at times one of those difficult people? Where am I showing up as one of those difficult people? Where am I rigid? Where am I controlling? Where am I less open-hearted than I need to be? Where am I condemning prior to investigation? Where am I prejudging? Where am I running storylines? It's so important for me to do that check-in. Was anybody here so many years ago when Bhante Sujatha sat in front of a very small group of us for like one of the first or second times, and there was a woman in the front row, and he just said, oh my gosh, you're fat. Can you imagine? Thank God at that time I wasn't a helper in cleaning up his actions. But since then, you have all heard him say the phrase, please listen to my heart, not my words. So English is his second language. And in fact, not only is it his second language, he's still, quite frankly, fragmented. We've all heard him. You know, Rahula has somewhat fragmented language, but frankly, it's a little clearer than Bhante sometimes. I love that part of him. But also in Sri Lanka, a heavier person is sort of considered a level of royalty. It is considered a sign of health and wealth and happiness and family ties and the ability to gather resources and feed your family. It's actually a very exalted thing. So here we were just having a cultural difference and a language difference, but we had a Sangha member who was gutted, as you can imagine. Just gutted. And so I love to remember that story because of the phrase, listen to my heart, not my words. And what that led me to realize is that we have a strange and rather pervasive human pattern, is that we tend to judge others by the impact of their actions. And yet we only judge ourselves by our intentions. Why do we do that? I'm very, very clear about when I blow it. I'm very clear, oh, I had such a good intention, but somehow it came out wrong, right? And yet, when somebody else does something to me, I struggle to remember that they probably had a good intention and it just came out awkwardly or falsely or, you know, in a different way. So I thought that was really interesting, is that we judge others. You know, we judge ourselves by our intentions, but for some reason, I continue to judge others by their actions. The next one is, I guess I would call it the practice of surrender. Eckhart Tolle says, whatever you fight, you strengthen, and whatever you resist, persists. Whatever you fight, you strengthen, and whatever you resist, persists. And so I'm a huge fan of being for things rather than against things. But I'm also, regrettably maybe, a huge fan of causing conflict. I really believe in conflicts of interest. I really believe when people say, I don't want to talk about politics or religion, I think that that is somewhat cowardly. And I really believe in having curiosity be a driving force in relationships. I want to know where we're different. And I want to, with an open-hearted, non-judgmental mindset, learn about your perspective so that I can check in on my own, and vice versa. I'm interested in those exchanges. And so when I am dealing with difficult parts of people, I'm trying to greet them with that same curiosity. Whatever you fight, you strengthen. Whatever you resist, persists. And instead, I'm like, wow, that's such an interesting point of view, rather than saying, I'm against that. I'd like to move into that with curiosity. And I recently did something in my organization where I brought sort of what we would call like an extremist person on the right politically and kind of an extremist person on the left. And I brought them on stage and I interviewed them. And in the series of 50 topics that I brought up that we discussed, we had a moderator that tracked it. And they were in total alignment. Now, these two people diabolically hated each other, would not even conceive of a conversation. Both want the other one out of the organization. I mean, we're talking like what you see on the news, those kind of extreme polarized people. In my 50 questions, which were very direct and pointed, they were in total alignment on 92% of the issues. Actually, they've become friends. They're now like going out to lunch, talking about their differences and their alignments, because it was so easy with two people who were willing to remain open. It was so easy to show how we have so much more in alignment than we do in disagreement. That's a really helpful practice when we think about dealing with the difficult parts of people. Bhante Sujatha taught me a long time ago, stop making things easy and always look for the more challenging point of view. This has been very frustrating for people like Rebecca and I, who work around here a lot, because Bhante almost never, ever compliments us. He rarely talks about what's going right around here. And if you are interacting with him behind the scenes, he'll say, well, I'm not going to waste my time with that. What's right is so evident and obvious. Let's just see what we can fix. Like, it's an efficiency thing for him. But he wants to find the challenging points of view because he thinks that's where the juice is, that's where the benefit is, that's where the value of learning how to repair is. And one of the things that he likes to say is, who wouldn't love a good person? Like, that's easy, right? Who wouldn't love a good person? To love a hateful person is the practice that we call loving kindness. I love all you guys. It's easy to love you. But I probably need to make sure I'm around people that I don't have that naturally evoked feeling with, because that's actually where I get to practice, right? That's where the work is. That's where the benefit for me will come from. This is so funny. I'm going to read a story from the Buddha, which I never do because I mostly can't tell if these are really fables and kind of like not real, or I'm just like super confused about like that kind of stuff. But I'm going to read it anyway because I sort of liked it. The Buddha once told this story. An ugly, hideous, smelly, and gross-looking monster went to see an emperor at his palace. When the monster walked in, the guards saw the monster and knew he did not belong there. So the guards screamed at the monster, calling him names and threatening the monster. And for every rude thing the guards said, the monster grew 1 inch bigger, uglier, and smellier. The guards then pulled out their swords, waving and striking it towards the monster and still yelling at the monster. And with every strike and word, the monster grew 1 inch bigger, uglier, and smellier. The monster got so big, it took up half the size of the courtyard. Then the emperor walks in and sees the monster. The emperor opens his arms and yelled, "Welcome!" And the monster grew 1 inch smaller, less uglier, and smellier. The emperor offered the monster water and food, and the monster grew smaller, less uglier, and smellier. And with every kind of word, gesture, and action, smaller, less uglier, and smellier the monster got. The monster got so small that one more kind word, it would disappear. And it did. Isn't that just so good? And so I have a real commitment to myself. I don't like to talk about wisdom if I don't also offer practical application in our lives 20 minutes from now. That's really a commitment of mine. So I came up with this thing called the difficult person exercise. The first one for a difficult person exercise is to reframe the moment. When someone we love or admire does something we don't like, it's easier to give them the benefit of the doubt. If they do something thoughtless, we attribute it to them having a bad day, not to them being a jerk. But when someone we know has a track record of bad behavior, we come to expect it, and we see everything they do through that lens. Imagine how you might react to the same behavior from someone you love. Number two, don't go looking for trouble. This is the simplest one, but definitely not the easiest. It's hard for our egos to let go of wanting to feel justified. Maybe this means minimizing your interactions. Maybe it means you choose to stay on easy topics when you have conversations. There will be enough times they rile you up or vice versa. There's no need to be the one to get it going. That's a little bit back to like that practice of pausing, right? Then the third one, I want to talk about this. You guys have heard me say a lot that I'm really interested in being a flagpole, not a flag. You know, a flag is like so susceptible to the wind, gets ripped and torn and crazy, but that flagpole remains so steady and current and constant. I'm really interested in that. But I heard another phrase recently that I'm really loving when it comes to dealing with difficult parts of people. Be a thermostat, not the thermometer. Be a thermostat, not a thermometer. What's a thermostat? A thermostat is the thing you do to adjust the temperature of something, of a space, of a situation, right? We turn down the heat, we turn up the heat. A thermometer simply says this is the heat, or this is the cool, this is the temperature. But a thermostat is taking a look at the temperature and then course correcting it to something that's a little bit more beneficial. Be a thermostat, not a thermometer. If we are consistently working on our own mindfulness, our own compassion, and our own presence, it's much easier to set the tone of an interaction. If we are running in a million directions, chaotic inside and out, and not practicing compassion towards ourselves, we will often end up reflecting back the chaos that comes our way to others instead. Imagine the person's negative acts as an illness. If you were standing next to someone and they were coughing like they were about to hack up a lung, chances are you'd feel sympathy, possibly offer assistance, and keep a healthy distance away. I've found this reframing to be incredibly helpful when dealing with difficult people. You wouldn't stand around and let someone throw up on you, but you probably wouldn't have some giant lingering towards them about it either. When someone is spewing garbage in your direction, see this for the illness that it is. Wish them well and take some space. Last one, Thich Nhat Hanh. We're going to Vietnam next month with Bhante and doing some really awesome humanitarian projects. So, of course, I became obsessed with Thich Nhat Hanh this month because that's his homeland. And so he wrote a really interesting essay called On Anger. About how spending time fuming over how you've been wronged is like finding your home on fire and going out and looking for the suspect instead of putting out the fire. Someone can give you garbage, but you don't have to keep it. If there's a lesson in it, keep that and let the rest go. And so he titles this simply letting go or surrender. Man, I really love this. I cannot tell you how many times I've gone and looked for the suspect instead of putting out the fire. Man, that's just like a real common thing for me. So I'm really, really grateful for the opportunity to practice these things so often. I'm in love with the next these next months of this like election season in the United States. What an incredible opportunity for us all to practice. What in it, unless you are somehow living in the woods, totally unconnected from anything that it possibly blinks, my guess is you will have to practice. What a gift. What a total gift. So I appreciate you all being here. We do have a few announcements. I'll jump into those. First of all, you guys know the statement that Rome wasn't built in a day. That's true, but the project for the temple took even longer, as you can tell by our ongoing construction mess outside. This project has been so interesting. Somehow we have systematically created a method to find the most unreliable workers in all of the surrounding counties. And so we've had a real opportunity to practice non-judgment and creative accountability and getting things done. But this process has led to, just like our spiritual lives, I think, more and more and more. And so what was supposed to be this fun little project of a new staircase and a great new garden where we're going to have Mother Mary and Jesus and Buddha all in the same devotional space, which I cannot wait for, and Kuan Yin. But it also led to us completely reshoring up this building so that we are going to be a gift to the next 100 years. We've done massive tuck pointing on every inch of this. We have resolved 20-year leaks in the basement. We have rebuilt foundations. This one idea led to the opportunity, because the building got exposed, to fix so much more at a foundational level. And I just would encourage us all, as we step over the construction debris, because the guys abandoned us before they even cleaned it up, and as you walk down our beautiful new stairs, and if you've been part of the frustration of those getting here, just, it is such a gorgeous metaphor of our own lives, that we start working on one thing, and by the willingness to do that, it opens up so many other things we get to work on. So that's the update. We are very close to done. As you can tell, we already have the Buddha statue planted and is set. If you've been around during some of the days, we've had a crane where Kuan Yin has literally been floating over the temple. And then the pedestal we built for her, the architect drew it too small, and it had to float back over the temple. So if anybody's interested in watching Kuan Yin fly, I'll let you know when the crane is coming again. Would you talk about your event tonight, Vante?
Yes. Tonight we have a metta sound healing and meditation with chakra healing, which I have been doing here, the chanting for last couple of weeks. There is a bracelet inside here, which was also blessed for 7 days while I was in Sri Lanka with 35 monks. And I have been chanting morning and evening 108 times for Ratana Sutra, which is for protection. So this will be given, but only there is 10 tickets or something like that left. It's today at 7 p.m. to 8:30. So if you're interested in meditation, healing through the sound bath with crystal singing bowls, so it's only a few tickets left if you want to participate. So.
Wonderful. Thank you. Those are $45. You can purchase them online or in the gift shop right afterwards. And if I could ask for volunteers, we would like to have all of the chairs and cushions moved after meditation. Where do you want them? You want chairs to go
out of the door.
Through those closet doors? So if everybody could, when you stand up, grab your chair and help stack it in that room, that'd be amazing. And then what do you want, the cushions here?
Yes.
Okay, and then cushions, we could just stack them up here, and let's try to keep the grate open. That'd be wonderful. Tomorrow, the 14th, we will begin a weekly healing-centered yoga class with trauma-informed yoga teacher Colleen Mary. Class is $15, and it's from 9 to 10. We will have a day retreat here at the temple on July 28th with our own Bhante Rahula. This will be from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. There will be various forms of the Buddha sutras, walking meditation, lunch, and, of course, a healing sound bath. The entire day is $95, and the itinerary is posted online. And I think we also have a flyer on our bulletin board there. And on Tuesday, July 30th, Gus, are you here? I think I saw you.
Yeah, he was here earlier.
Okay, Gus, you want to talk about it, your event?
No, he was earlier.
Oh, he left. I don't have my glasses. Gus is going to be doing a 5-week seminar on the Buddha and Augustine of Hippo. There's a one-time fee of $50 to participate. And then just a reminder that our Amazon wish list is posted in the social hall. What we do is everything that the temple needs and everything the monks need, we try to anticipate in advance, and we put it on the Amazon wish list so that those of you who are practicing dana or generosity, if you're interested in helping the temple beyond your monthly pledge or any other monetary forms, if you're able to buy stuff online for us through that gift store, then it'll just immediately get shipped here. It's a really easy way. We try to put stuff up 2 or 3 weeks before we actually have to go buy it, so you can trust that that list is accurate, and we'd really appreciate you grabbing anything that's on there that you're able to. If you are new or you've not yet signed up for our weekly email blast, we've got a great newsletter every week we send out saying everything that's going on in the temple, which is way more than we offer in the announcements. And so please sign up for that. And I think that's it. Thanks, okay. Monk. Good job today. I'm glad you got a break.
Thank you. Thank you, Tyler. That was wonderful. So thank you all for coming today. Of course, we have a farmer's market. There is Sri Lankan food there if you would like to get some spicy food. So don't forget it. And the people who just came new, I got a little gift for all of you. So thank you all for coming today. Have a great day. Thank you.
Thanks, Monk.